We're doing in Yaakov, we're up to Shabbos Chaf Bet Amud Aleph, page Chet in the standard editions. Amar Rav Kahana. Rav Kahana taught the following, Darash Rav Natan Bar Minyumei, Mishmeid Rabbi Tanchum. Rabbi Natan, the son of Minyumei, said the following derivation in the name of Rabbi Tanchum. He didn't hear it directly from him. The word Mishmei is like Mishum, Mishem in the name of, but he didn't hear it directly. And he said the following. Mai dichtiv, what does the verse mean when it describes the pit that the brothers were going to throw Joseph into? And that's a pivotal moment in Jewish history because we're still... That moment opened a debt for the Jewish people for a long time, quite possibly till today. That moment of enmity between the brothers when they tear off his colored coat and they throw him into the pit, that was a breaking point in Jewish history. So when we look at that, the pit is described in detail. The Torah says, "V'habor reik en bo mayim." The pit they were going to throw him into was empty. It had no water. From the understanding of what it says, the pit was empty. Don't I know that there was no water inside? So then what am I supposed to learn from the wording ein bo mayim? There was no water inside. So before we read the answer, we need to introduce the concept. In logic, we have a double negative, right? I don't want to eat supper. I don't not want to eat supper means I do want to eat supper, right? So a double negative is inclusive. The same is true verbally, right, as we just saw, and the same is true in Torah. When the Torah uses two limiting terms, two terms that are diminishing in meaning, we say, en mi'ut achar mi'ut, ela lerabot. Mi'ut achar mi'ut, two terms that are there to diminish understanding, are actually there to indicate the opposite. It's like a double negative. It's coming to say more. So if the Torah said the pit was empty, there was no water inside, so you have two terms that describe it was lacking. That's coming to tell you, wait, it was lacking, but it had something else. Oh, you were there. Mayim ein bo, aval nechashim v'akravim yesh bo. The fact that the Torah reiterated the emptiness, it was coming to tell you, yeah, it was empty from water, but there was something else there. There was snakes and scorpions. So the brothers were throwing Joseph into a pit that was not only empty, yeah, it was empty, there was no water. That's telling you there was something else there.
Wait, but that includes something, like the scorpions and the snakes or something. And it says it's empty. If I say something's empty, forget about the second statement saying there's no water in it. That means it's empty.
Okay, so let's take an example from here. Your kid comes to you and says, Dad, can I have ice cream? And you say, I'm not giving out ice cream today. I'm not giving you ice cream today. And then you proceed to take ice cream. Did you really contradict what you said? You began by saying a general no, and then you limited it and said a specific no. So if the kid was sharp, he might catch on. And he might ask you, but Dad, are you going to give anyone else? Because it would have been enough to say the first statement, I'm not giving anyone. When you added, I'm not giving you, you've given an indication, okay, I'm changing what I said in the beginning. The second negative is modifying the first negative, indicating there's going to be a positive. If you give his sibling, he'll say, but I thought you said I'm not giving anyone. You'll say, right, but then I said I'm not giving you.
There's no water, but there were scorpions.
But to say there's no anything. Snakes and scorpions.
It's a roundabout way.
Okay.
And it seems like the Torah doesn't waste any words. So why
right.
Would If it's just coming to tell us something that could have been said in a sentence, why wouldn't it have told us in that sentence instead of wasting two sentences to tell us that?
Okay, so now we have to go in depth, but that's fine. Let's understand what.
Is there something we learn out from here other than?
Wait. We're dealing with this question. Then we can go on to the next one. I have one question. I in general here at the Machon, I try not to quote because I find it to be daunting when a lot of sources are quoted. On such a deep question, I'm just asking myself if it's if it wouldn't be in your interest to start quoting the sources just so you get a picture of where this is coming from. On the other hand, I still think it's daunting to hear sources. So do you guys prefer I'll just say the answer without going into where I'm getting it from? Yeah?
Time for me is this time too.
What's the vote? How many people want to hear the sources? Okay, so you're outnumbered. Okay. So our story begins with Maimonides and his introduction to the Sefer HaMitzvos, where Maimonides speaks about things that are derived from the 13 laws of derivation. We assume that anything that's derived with laws of derivation, like we just quoted a law of derivation, is biblical. But it's not in the same weight as something that's written overtly in the Torah. And this is a concept that is supported in many places. The question is, how big of a difference of weight is there? And sometimes we say the tradition or the derivation seems to completely unravel, undo, overwrite the literal meaning of the pasuk. It says an eye for an eye. You can't do an eye for an eye. Our tradition is that's not what you're going to do here. So it seems sometimes that a law of derivation or a traditional understanding overwrites, completely deletes the simple literal meaning of the pasuk. The Rambam here quotes a concept that appears in the Talmud often, in Mikra Yotze Midei Pshuto. A verse always retains its literal meaning. Okay, so you're never going to be able to do an eye for an eye, but there's still going to be some relevance to the literal meaning. Now, the Talmud...
An eye for an eye. We don't, but people do.
That doesn't affect us. That's irrelevant here.
Okay.
The Talmud tells us in Tractate Shabbos that Rav Kahana had learned the whole Torah, and he'd learned it more than once, and he never encountered this concept, en mikra yotze midei pshuto, that the literal meaning is of importance, meaning the way they always learned Tanakh was with the traditional interpretations, with the laws of derivation. It's another thought. You have to bear in mind that the literal meaning also carries weight. Very different than the way we would think. We think the base is the literal meaning. And then you have time, you learn what Chazal have to say. No, you want to learn Torah. The only way to learn Torah is with our sages' interpretation. By the way, that's why I'm not a fan of, I don't see one here, the Koren Tanakhs. Those Tanakhs and the Mishnayos that they print today that has the text without any interpretation. So what's the point? That's the last step, figuring out what the literal meaning was. It's not the first step. The first step is to understand it based on tradition. You see, Rav Kahana had already mastered all of Torah. He hadn't yet reached that. And when he heard it, he suddenly said, wow, oh boy, there's also a weight to the literal meaning. So there is a weight. And when we have something that's derived or something that's literal, when we have a halacha stemming from the literal text or derived from the text, there is a greater weight to that which is written overtly. That is true. But the literal meaning, pshuto shel mikra, well, that's a level we have to remember still exists. Now let's go back to our discussion. When we have a pasuk that says something and it has a literal meaning, then the sages come and use a law of derivation to derive something and say, well, this halacha is applied a little differently than you'd understand literally. And sometimes it seems to overwrite the literal meaning of the pasuk. So the Brisker Rav, he was rabbi in Volozhin 150 years ago, he said the following rule. He said, you have to view it as coins, as though you have a stack of coins. Each coin is slightly smaller than the one beneath it. And you see the top coin. But you see, on the outskirts of the coin, you see the boundary of the previous coin. Or, in modern terminology, you have to view it as windows. Where you can have a window that's taking up most of the screen, but not all of the screen. So there's a residual effect from the window behind it. And that, so Rav, the Brisker Rav said it with coins, but he was coming to say that when our sages gave an interpretation in the Pasuk, that interpretation does not completely override the literal meaning of the Pasuk. That interpretation is the prime interpretation. It's the coin you see most of, but there's a residual effect from the literal meaning of the Pasuk. What is that residual effect? In every case, you have to analyze it anew. It's not like there's a rule what the residual effect is going to be. The more you understand the derivation and the halacha and the applications, the more you'll be able to find the residual effect of the literal meaning of the Pasuk. So far, you guys with me? So now let's apply it here. The Pasuk says, Vaborek, the pit was empty. In Bumaim, there was no water inside. Along come our sages and say, okay, you want to know what was really going on here? There were snakes and scorpions down on the bottom. Oh, then why did it say the pit was empty, there was no water? Perhaps because when the brothers came to the pit, they were not intending to murder Yosef. They said that clearly. Throwing someone on top of snakes and scorpions is the equivalent of murdering them. That was not their intent. Their intent was to hold him in hostage. Their intent was to keep him there as they thought what would happen. They said, maybe we'll just leave him there. We won't actively kill him. But they did not intend to throw him on snakes and scorpions. The pit was very deep. What they saw was they chucked a rock inside and they didn't hear a splash. So they knew they weren't drowning him. So v'haborek, from the brother's perspective, they saw the pit was empty. And b'maim, there was no water inside. So they weren't killing Yosef by putting him in the pit. Come our sages and say, wait, but the Pasuk's telling you something else. The literal meaning is telling you perhaps the brother's perspective. The Torah took pains to word it this way to tell you, but you should know there was something else going on here. And when they take Yosef out of the pit, Yosef, who is the cherished child of the man who is so wealthy, Yaakov Avinu, how come they get a dismal price for him on the slave market? He was gorgeous. You see, when he comes down to Egypt, one of the top politicians purchases him. So how come the brothers sold him so cheap? Because there were snakes and scorpions on the bottom. And it was a miracle that he wasn't killed. But nonetheless, he was down there looking all around him at snakes and scorpions moving all around him. And he became so scared and so pale. And he begged them and pleaded, take me out of here. That by the time it came time to sell him, he looked emaciated. He looked as though he'd seen a devil. He had. He had just spent hours with snakes and scorpions. So on the one hand, you could view that as, well, when he walked away alive, he was being told by God, I love you. Even in this moment, all of nature would have had it that you should have died in this moment, and we're getting a different picture of Yosef. He's being pulled out of the pit, and he's being told, your brothers hate you. You don't know what your father thinks about you, but you know that God loves you. Because you just had a miracle, the equivalent of Daniel in the lion's den. You sat there with snakes and scorpions, and you couldn't do anything, and you walked out alive. And with that message, Yosef goes down to Egypt. So the idea that there were snakes and scorpions down there changes the whole picture where Yosef is before he goes down to Egypt. Yes?
Just a question. In this same section, I'm not mistaken, the brothers are eating, right? And isn't he screaming? I mean, there's something going on there. They may not have meant to kill him, but it's almost like, what's the word, aggravated manslaughter. Where you're not trying to kill the person, but if he dies, that's as opposed to second-degree murder where you're trying to kill him. It would seem that. That's why I'm asking you. Was he in earshot, or they may have thought he was just screaming because he was in terror and he wasn't really screaming for his life? I don't know.
So let's go over the verses. It says, Yosef was on his way. He was told they were in Dothan. They saw him from a distance. And they thought to kill him. They said, here's the dreamer coming. Now let's kill him. And after we kill him, we'll throw him We'll throw into one of the pits. V'amanu, and we'll tell our dad, chayaha chalatu, a wild animal devoured him. V'yishma Reuven, Reuven heard, v'yatzilel miyadam, he wanted to save him from their hands. V'yomer, Reuven said, lo nakenu nafesh, let's not hit him a mortal blow. Rather, Reuven says, al tishpichu dam, don't spill blood, hashlichu oto, throw him, elachad abrot asher bamidbar, into one of the pits down here, v'yad al tishpichu bo, but don't hit him. Leman atzil oto lashivo laviv, Reuven's plan, when he says throw him into the pit, is to save him and bring him back home ultimately. So when they throw him into the pit, and he says, guys, don't do this to me, hey, wait, Reuven convinces them all to shift away from the pit. Reuven's intention is, this way I'll be able to slip back and take him out of the pit. When we learned the parasha, we saw that it's not so clear who took him out of the pit and sold him. Meaning the brothers come back to the pit and he's gone. That's how many Rishonim learn. It says, Vayavru anashim idanim socharim vayimshechu vayalut Yosef minabor. It says, Midianite merchants passed by, they pulled him out and sold him to the Yishmaelim. Who pulled him out? Who sold him? The literal reading of the text says, the Midianites pulled him out, they were looking him over, here's a naked Hebrew white boy, and then the Ishmaelim come by, and the Midianites say, hey guys, you want to buy a slave? They sell him to the Ishmaelim. And then the brothers say, hey, where's Yosef? What are we going to do now? He's gone. They come back home, he's not there. Now what are they supposed to say? So that's, I'm saying it's not so clear how it played itself out. But they definitely moved away. We'll just conclude with one interesting thought. One of the commentaries says, okay, the verse said the pit was empty, there was no water, to indicate but there was something else inside. Maybe there were rocks. How do you know there was snakes and scorpions? So he says, from the verse you just quoted, he says, you have to, the verse says, they threw him into the pit, and the pit was empty, there was no water. Vayeshevu lechol lechem, they sat down to eat bread. So instead of reading it as Vayeshevu lechol lechem, he says read it as Vayesh bo lechol lechem. And within the pit were vermin, were creatures that could consume. And that's how we know that the pit was empty of water, Vayesh bo lechol, but inside.
That reading they weren't eating. They just was talking about the pit.
Okay, it's a drasha.
In some ways, I mean, it, you know, to sit there, even though you thought your brother was, you know, on the lace of whatever, I mean, they thought this guy was, I think they thought he was a problem. These were the 12 tribes, right?
They thought he was so evil he deserved to
right.
die.
So, but even so, to sit there eating, what we learned a week or two ago in one of these classes, one of the marks of a Jew is not to be, you know, cruel. You know,
so remind me.
Eating your meal while your brother is screaming, even if you think that is the rough one.
Thursday night.
Okay.